and we want to help you make this make an album. And it was an album that I hadn't said I wanted to make. You know, it was a crazy email to receive. Like, I thought, this has to be a joke. Like, what are you talking about? You know, like, it's crazy. Like, I'm singing in like a, you know, a minority language that not that many people speak.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. The wonderful singer, fiddler, songwriter, and scholar Lily Henley breathes new life into the endangered language Ladino, a fusion of Spanish, Hebrew, Arabic, and Turkish. During this podcast, you'll hear clips from her album Horas Desahoradas. Blending her roots in American and Celtic music, Lily creates powerful, original music that honors centuries of Sephardic women's voices. These songs tell timeless stories of love, loss, exile, and resilience, sharing her personal connection to this important tradition. You'll learn about Sephardic history and contemporary communities, Lily's unusual childhood, and how she's learned to trust her voice. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including different ways to support this podcast. Hey, Lily, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I've really, really enjoyed your album of Ladino songs, as well as your first album, which I hope we'll talk about that too. But I've really listened to your more recent album many, many times, Horas Desahoradas, is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Horas Desahoradas, yes.
So Hours Without Hours. So you have been studying Sephardic culture for many, many years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a part of your family background. Do you want to speak to that first?
I guess I could speak to that for a long time. So I guess I'd ask if you could be more specific. I mean, I do. I am Sephardic, and I've been singing in Ladino since I was a kid. And maybe it's helpful to just say what Ladino is. Ladino is our heritage language. It's kind of a, I guess what I would say is like a linguistic geography of the Sephardic diaspora. We are of the Jewish people that were expelled from the Inquisition in the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and Portugal. The language and culture really developed after the expulsion. So people came out of the Iberian Peninsula speaking Castellano, like the older forms of Spanish and Portuguese and other, you know, like related dialectic languages, and came into Morocco in the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire stretched across all of North Africa into the Near East and the Southern Mediterranean, so like the Balkans. It kind of depends on which period you look at, because it was hundreds of years. But all of the languages and kind of like vocabulary from Hebrew and from Ottoman languages, so from Turkish, from French and Persian, Italian, Greek, Bulgarian, entered that old Castellano and became part of the development of Ladino. So Ladino is an Ottoman language. There's a kind of dialect of it, or a related spoken language called Hakitia, that is the Moroccan version, that has a little bit more of the Castellano, maybe more Arabic, and it has the Hebrew, but it has less of the Ottoman influences, but it's closely related. And it was spoken by Sephardic Jews across that whole region for hundreds of years, and then like quite quickly was endangered in the 20th century. So it's considered an endangered language by the Endangered Language Alliance, and it's still spoken. It's a living language, and that's one of the misconceptions that I, you know, my music kind of has two sides. On the one hand, I'm an artist. I care so much about, you know, beauty and entertainment and, you know, connectivity, and I have a lot of different musical influences, but there's kind of a side to the music that I'm making that is bringing this like endangered language and culture to people that, you know, maybe haven't heard it or haven't heard it very much or just don't know a lot about it. In the United States, most Jewish people come from an Ashkenazi background, so it's much less common. I grew up singing in Ladino, but my kind of deep dive into it has happened in the last decade through many different, you know, travels and studies. And some of it has been like very official and some of it has just been me being a nerd. So yeah, I don't know. I'm like, I really attribute that to being a folk musician and just kind of the many years that I've spent, you know, learning new tunes on the fiddle and learning ballads and songs from different traditions, that sort of gave me sort of the immediate tools for going deeper into my own cultural tradition.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, we'll definitely dive in a little bit later into some of your mentors and specific research. But in terms of your life as a child, I mean, I find it so inspiring that this language was preserved over hundreds and hundreds of years and so much travel throughout a huge diaspora. Did you understand that those songs you were learning, what that was about?
Yeah, and I actually have to say, like, I feel like elders in my community would dislike the word preserved. Because it really is just a development, like human culture just develops, you know, it's always changing. So like, for instance, in the United States, when we're, you know, playing, you know, old time music, you know, sometimes the songs are really old, but they've changed a lot. You know, there's a lot of change that happens. So yeah, I mean, when I was a really young kid, it's an interesting question. I don't know if I was like, I definitely was thinking about my ancestors or like ancestral, you know, culture. I do think that that's like a common thing in Jewish culture across the board. Like you think about, you know, a lot of holidays have to do with who's come before you and what happened a long time ago and how it relates to your life now, like ways of making something modern for you now. But at the same time, probably the most famous song in Ladino is, it's not my favorite song, I'm just going to say, but it's the song Ocho Candelicas, which is a song for the Hanukkah festival. And it was written in the 80s, I think, the 80s by Flory Jagoda, who was a modern songwriter who had fled the Holocaust in the Balkans in what was at one point the Ottoman Empire. And she sang lots of traditional songs from her family, but she also wrote so many songs. And she was just not, you know, I think like the concept of singer-songwriter is much more recent than writing songs is. So she just didn't make a really big deal out of, oh, this was my song, I wrote this one, and this was an old song. So you often hear that song introduced by people outside of our community as a traditional, like, Spanish Hanukkah song, you know, and it's actually like a modern Hanukkah song in the modern Ladino language, you know, that she spoke as a kid. She died in 2021, you know, so I do think that I thought about ancestry and culture and heritage and connectivity to the past, but I also did not think of Ladino as like an ancient hundreds of years old. And actually Ladino in terms of linguistic development it's much newer than lots of languages. I mean, a language like Gaelic or the languages that have influenced Ladino, all of those languages are much more ancient than Ladino itself. So I think of Ladino as being a longstanding heritage connecting us back, but I also spend a lot of my time kind of correcting this perception that, you know, it's ancient and it's from long ago. And it almost is a correction to the perception that, you know, on the one hand, that you couldn't be creative and do new things in it and that there aren't resources for that. And it's also a correction for people that might do whatever they want with it without doing a real deep dive, because it's still a living language and there are like things that are true about it and things that are not true. So yeah, I think of it that way, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on this album, you have some traditional ballads that you've written new music for and also some of your own original lyrics?
Yeah. It was very nerve-wracking to write the ones that I wrote music for. I don't know why. I'm still sort of parsing why that was a challenging thing to do, because it's obviously like there are so many new melodies for lyrics that are old in not just in Sephardic tradition, but in like every song tradition. And I grew up, you know, in the Celtic music world and in the American, you know, folk music world. And, you know, and even in like the, you know, rock or popular music, there's so many examples. Like the 60s folk revival had so many like new versions of things, like new melodies. Martin Carthy and people like that wrote new melodies for old lyrics. You know, when you look up like the Child Ballad Collection, those are lyric collections, really. They're like story collections almost. So people write all these. So for some reason I found, and this probably goes back to the root of feeling like Sephardic music and Sephardic culture is somehow this like preserved thing. I felt, even as a Sephardic person, like, I need somebody's permission. Like, can somebody tell me that it's like okay to do this? Like, is someone going to be mad? And luckily I got that permission and I made my album in collaboration with the Sephardic community in Paris, which was the beginning of like a really deep dive into Sephardic language and culture. But and it's a deep dive I'm continuously on. Like, I can't imagine ever not continuing forward with it. Like, I don't think we're ever like true experts of our cultures and repertoires, but I do feel like I needed that permission. And it felt really, really natural. Like, it just felt, you know, I had these lyrics that felt very present and modern. And I, you know, some of the traditional melodies that I know, because I, you know, I do sing traditional melodies. There's only one on the album. It's the very last track on the album that's almost solo. But I do sing those, but, you know, I literally have no memory really of writing any of those melodies. Like, they just happened with the lyrics and then I arranged them. And I was really fortunate to get the chance through those connections in Paris, to work with, people like Marie-Christine Bornes-Varol, who's like a foremost expert on Ladino and incredibly fluent. And, Francois Azar, who actually is like the producer on the album, who's a Ladino speaker. So I had the chance to co-write songs. And there are three completely new Ladino songs on the album. And I sing them in my concerts. And it feels really, yeah. So the album is composed of both like new, absolutely new songs and these like recreated old songs. And I think that writing the new melodies for the old lyrics has helped me a lot in creating like a genre for myself, like a style for myself that allows all the different influences that are true to me as an artist. Like, I just don't think it would have been very exciting to continue to just make sort of versions of the old songs with their old melodies. Not even because they're old, but just because they're someone else's and I'm a composer. So, and I'm a songwriter and I write in English also, and I needed something that would help connect all of those influences, and that was kind of the key for me.
Well, I was hoping to include some clips, and of course your album is linked right in the show notes. A lot of these songs are about strong women, and I thought maybe we could start with the clip of Esta Noche Te Amore.
Oh yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to speak to that song a little bit?
Yeah, that's a song that I wrote, and I actually, it's the only time that this has happened, but I wrote like a whole lyric in English. And it was, there's this child ballad that I think was made popular by Martin Carthy. The child ballads are, I mean, a lot, probably many of your listeners know, but it's just a collection of all these old English, Irish, and Scottish ballads. And there's this ballad called Cold, Haily, Windy Night, or that's one name for it. And it, I think the underlying story is it has this this trope in it, this, you know, man knocks on window in middle of night, like woman says, no, no, my parents will hear you, and then lets him in anyway. And they like, you know, they have a midnight tryst, and then she asks him to marry her and he rejects her and leaves. And it's called the Night Visitor the night visitor trope. And it, one of my favorite singers of like the old tradition of ballads, John Doyle, who's an unbelievable guitar player, he has this incredible version of the song, and I was really obsessed with it. And but you know, the story is just so like the woman is always done wrong in the story. It's like so frustrating. And I thought, like, I'll try writing it, but reversed, like them all of the same things happen, but at the end the man wants to marry her and she's like, this was fun, but no, you know. And I wrote it in English and it just didn't work. Like it just didn't feel, it felt, yeah, like not, it felt forced, and I never performed it. And then when I was working on this new album, I thought, what if I translated into Ladino? And I worked on this translation, and I worked with Marie Christine, who's, you know, she would never call herself a, she wouldn't say that she's, you know, a music expert, but she is like a carrier of, she sings a lot of songs. She really knows the older Sephardic ballad tradition. And I guess when I'm saying ballads, I just mean songs. We have all these different words for the different kinds of songs. And I said, like, we know we worked through it, and it was very collaborative. And then I said, like, what do you think, like, from your perspective, you know, how does this feel? And she was like, it totally works. Like, you know, it's like the strong woman, you know, not to be, of course, there are songs in the Sephardic repertoire that where women get done wrong and like have a hard time, or are complaining or whatever. But, there are a lot of songs where women have like a strong force. And she said, oh, it just fits right in with those. And that's how I felt too. Like it felt much more natural to sing it. Yeah, that's really the background to that song. It's the longest song on the album, and it was really fun to record it. Yeah.
Que anoche estaba echada sola en su cama cuando sintió que shafteaban y brilló una luz tras la ventana. Aquí estaba detrás del jam con la velica en la mano, protegiéndola porque hacía lluvia. Si afitaba que uno viera tu vela brillando en la montaña, aclarándonos las caras, centellando en el quenar. Se quedó mirando solombras en su falla luz. El tino en la calor de su abrazo. Me dejarás que entre por ti camine y camino largo esperando solo por decirte cuánto te quiero y esta noche te amaré. Sin ruido levanto la ventana contra la pared. Ramas de sarma chic y metal titreaban en el aire. Asumió su amante y la tomó en brazos, a salvo en la oscuridad de la luna. Me dejarás que entre por ti camine y camino la.
Thanks for that. So I was going to ask you about Marie-Christine, like how you met her and what that mentorship relationship looked like. You got a Fulbright to go have a residency in Paris?
Yeah, so I had thought about doing the Fulbright for like a decade, and the deadline would just come up every year and I'd miss it. You know, I just wouldn't have the right material. And then basically I posted this song, and I was contacted by the vice president of Aquí Estamos, which is the Ladino revitalization organization in Paris. They said, we really love this new thing that you're doing, and we want to invite you to come to the Festival of Jewish Culture in Paris and headline the Ladino Day. And we want to help you make an album. And it was an album that I hadn't said I wanted to make. You know, it was a crazy email to receive. Like I thought, this has to be a joke. like, what are you talking about? You know, like, it's crazy. Like, I'm singing in like a, you know, a minority language that not that many people speak. And, you know, this is a person that speaks, you know, fluently. And it was very exciting. And, you know, so I went there in 2019 and did that and made those connections. And I got to meet with Marie-Christine during that visit. And then the pandemic hit. And I lost, like, the album didn't get released right away, and I lost, like, all of my concerts and, like, everything I was planning, and I had all this time, and I applied. It took me, like, 6 weeks to do the application, and I had these connections. I really wanted to go back to Paris, and there's a collegiate-level Ladino course that happens there at the Institute of Language and Culture, and, you know, she runs a class, like, every week, also with advanced students, and... she's just a very lovely, like, person. It's like hanging out with somebody and going back in time. Not so much because of Ladino, but because, you know, she's hard to get a hold of, and she, you know, she lives in, like, near the Gare du Nord, like in like an ancient apartment. And her husband is a native Ladino speaker from Istanbul. You know, it was just like an incredible connection. And she's so generous, you know, to anybody who is really doing a deep dive into this culture and language. I think she always says that, like, learning Ladino and investing herself in Ladino saved her life. And it's so interesting because she's neither Jewish nor Sephardic. I mean, obviously with a name like Marie-Christine. So it's really, you know, she has such a deep understanding and knowledge of the culture and language that I've heard her speak Spanish, and it's like she has a Ladino accent when she speaks Spanish. And, you know, her husband is a native Ladino speaker, and, you know, I would go over their house and sit in their salon, and we would just speak Ladino. And I don't think I've ever spoken to him in a language that is not Ladino. So, yeah, that was that connection. And, you know, I don't talk to her that often, but I still, you know, she's still like a very dear person to me.
Yeah. And you learned Spanish growing up?
Yeah.
So how close are they, these languages?
You know, I'm going to give an answer that I heard somebody at Ladino 21, Carlos Yebra Lopez, I heard him give this answer. He's both a native Spanish speaker from Spain and also a Ladino speaker. And I liked what he said, which was, it depends who's talking to who, like, because of course they are really closely related in grammar and in a lot of vocabulary. They're not the same language. Ladino is not a dialect of, I'm not a linguist, but I know that. I know that it's not a dialect of Spanish, but it is, you know, it is one of those languages where it can be mutually intelligible. So if a Ladino speaker is speaking to a Spanish speaker, they'll choose different words, you know, they might choose words that they would not use if they were speaking to a Ladino speaker. I could go deep into it. I don't think it would be interesting to your listeners, but they are directly connected and also separate. And I mean, I guess like a good example of that is like if I, you know, and it also depends where you're from as a Ladino speaker. And that's all changing all the time because, you know, the diaspora is very wide, and it's really hard to maintain small dialectic differences that would have existed between, you know, if you were living in Salonika in what is now Greece, you would have one way of speaking. And if you lived in Istanbul or Izmir in what is now Turkey, you would have one way of speaking. It would be intelligible. But for instance, if I was talking to a Spanish speaker, I might say la cocina to say the kitchen. But if I was speaking, you know, in a Ladino context, I might use the word mupak, which is a Turkish root word that also is the word for kitchen. So it, in a mupak is a word that no Spanish speaker would understand. You know, they would have to put two and two together. So it kind of just depends, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. I know with Yiddish that there's definitely that kind of code switching that happened. Yeah, using more Hebrew-derived words as opposed to German or Slavic.
Yeah, and I love that you say that because it's, I have heard both of German speakers saying, oh yeah, I can understand like a bunch of Yiddish, we can talk. And then at the same time, there are all these like resistance stories of people singing to each other in Yiddish during the Holocaust and it kind of passing over the heads of people that were German speaking. So it really, I mean, language is amazing. Like, and it's not that I'm like I'm not a linguist, but it's very inspiring to me, like just how it develops and people's accents and, you know, to me, also just because I'm using my ears all the time, as a musician, I just think language has so much to do with why music, or I don't know what started it, but you can feel the difference in music also in how people speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first song on this album, Duermite Mi Alma, do you want to speak to that? Mm-hmm. And we could include a clip.
Yeah, that's a song. I mean, at some point I'm going to have to retire. It's a very funny story and I love telling it on stage. But it's a song that has lyrics that are quite, you know, at least the first part of it is pretty well known in the sort of Latino world, like, you know, Sephardic music world. And it's the beginning of the story says, sleep, my darling, sleep, my child. Your father is out with another woman. And then the second verse says, I followed him and saw this beautiful meal that he'd laid out for them, or that they were having together. And the chorus or the refrain says, new love, new pain. You know, so it's a song of the woman that has a baby and her husband is cheating on her. And I sang this, I created this version, it just happened. Like it just felt, this melody just felt, it just felt, the lyrics fell right into it. And right before I recorded the album, I went and met with Susanna Weichschaha, who's like really one of the most important modern collectors. She's an ethnomusicologist, didn't really work as a professor or anything like that. Like she, you know, is just a deep, deep folklorist and song collector. And she, I just went to her because I just wanted her take. I didn't expect to please her. She, you know, she's like in her 80s and she's, you know, has really specific opinions about the music and stuff. But I really just felt like I want her take on this new thing that I'm doing and how to, you know, she's a musician. So how does this fit into the melody? And she said, oh, very nice, like very nice. But you're missing the second half of the story. And you know, he comes home, she brought out like actually two manuscripts so we could compare and contrast like the versions. But basically he comes home and he says, open my sweetheart, open my darling. You know, he repeats the same lines from the beginning. I'm so tired from my day on the road. And she says, well, wherever you spent the day, you can also spend the night, you know? And he goes, demon of a woman who told you. And she says, hombre del huerco, devil of a man. I discovered it for myself. And she locks him out of the house. Like he's knocked on the door because he's been locked out. I just think it's an incredible song. Like, you know, it is one of those like empowered women songs. It's also just, you know, when you think about these songs, like back then it would have been, you know, hypothetically, you would have been so much more dependent on, you know, your husband. So it's quite an act of bravery to just be like, you can't come in. And I also think like, if it were like a Celtic or like American folk song lyric, she would have killed him. I think she would have killed him. So I think that that's also, I mean, maybe there's a version that I don't know where she does kill him, but I do think she just locks him out. And in the different versions, there were many locks on her door. Like she locks, I chose 7, but I think one version had like 11. And it's like, okay, so it's happened like a bunch of times and she keeps adding a lock. Like, I don't know. So anyway, that's the story behind this song.
Dormite mi alma, dormite mi vida, que tu padre viene. Mueva amiga, me fui detrás de por ver dónde iba, vi de que se iba, de donde mueva amiga, muevo amor. Entré más adentro por ver lo que había y de meses pues ricas comidas, yo me fui a mi casa, triste y afligada. Yo cerré mis puertas con 7 andravías, muevo dolor.
Okay, wonderful. So you're going back to school, you're going to Harvard to do your doctorate?
Yeah.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you, with Paulina Shepherd, Ida Gilner, Jean Rowe, Kavisha Matsala, Yael Strom, and Alicia Spiegels. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support this series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please share it with a friend. Thanks.
I did an MA in ethnomusicology that I finished last May, and I toured straight through my whole MA, both as a soloist, and I also spent a year and a half playing with this band called Rising Appalachia that's kind of in between several genres, and, you know, I played fiddle and guitar and sang, and that was really like a test, because I don't, like, I have no interest in, like, going into academia and giving up my work as an artist and as a performer. So I just wanted to see, like, can I do both? But for me, you know, I'm doing this work anyway. Like, I'm just so nerdy. I'm also creating music with people that are incredibly meaningful, you know, musicians to me, and thinking about, you know, developing my craft and, you know, practicing my instrument. So it's a lot to balance, but it went well, and I took 1 year off just to tour and applied to school. And yeah, it's Harvard, mainly because of who I'll get to work with there, that it's the right fit for the project that I'm hoping to do.
But yeah. Do you want to speak to who you'll get to work with or not?
My advisor at Harvard will likely be a musicologist called Alejandro Madrid, who is, you know, a foremost expert in sort of diasporic music in Mexico. And I think he's always had an interest in Sephardic music. Actually, he told me that he had considered doing Sephardic music when he was at his dissertation level. And it's going to be a really interesting adventure. I'm like so early in it that I don't know what to say, and I'm sure it'll be like a really challenging balancing act, but I'm not completely alone. There are several musicians that I respect so deeply who are also like have an academic life additionally. Like Jake Blunt is at Brown, and he's an incredible, you know, culture bearer and musician. And there are several other people that, you know, when I'm really freaking out or just feeling ridiculous, like, you know, it's just a ridiculous two worlds to like kind of live in. I'm like trying not to take myself too seriously. You know, I don't think I imagined myself as an academic, before this happened. It just really was, okay, I am doing all this work, and I'm every piece of music that I write or arrangement that I create is deeply informed by, you know, all this study that I'm kind of doing. You know, what could support that? And that it was like a slow, you know, the Fulbright was the beginning, and it was just like a slow trajectory down into that. But I do reach out to my other touring academic friends, because it is like a weird and kind of unique, strange experience to kind of be doing both those things at the same time.
Yeah, well, good for you. So your family moved around quite a bit when you were a kid.
Yeah, I moved. My dad was a physician in the Indian Health Service, which is Indian like native people in the United States. So when I was born, we were living on the Hopi Reservation in Arizona, and you know, my very first words were in Hopi, just because I was surrounded by. So maybe that was. I can't think of, you know, the Hopi language is a really vibrant living language, but it's also spoken by very few people. It's a very small population. But yeah, it helped that that's what he did. But my mom was really like, my mom just can't decide where she wants to live. And she's always talking about where she thinks she might move next. And so we moved a lot. I think I moved 10 times before I was 10. And all over the United States, I spent like short stints in Thailand and in Inuit village in Alaska, and on Kodiak Island in Alaska. I had like very small moments in places like that, and then like I lived all over the Southwest and the Midwest and the Northeast, and yeah, I don't know any other. I'm not sure. People always say, well, did you like it or was it good? You know, and there were really rough things about it and really great things about it. Maybe my perspective on the world and my interest in other people and in other ways of thinking and living, and maybe that comes from it. It was also challenging because it's really hard to be constantly the new person coming in. But I just don't know what, I don't know what the alternative would have been like. So I can't really say, oh, it was definitely in comparison to the alternative, good or bad, but it, that, that just was. And I haven't, the longest I've ever lived anywhere was, 9 years in New York City. But I was traveling all the time. So I don't totally know, because I'm a touring musician, I don't totally know what it would be like to ever just like be in one place and just be there. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it just makes me think about how a lot of us are very tied to our sense of place and our belongings, maybe a bit too much. And maybe you gained a certain freedom from that.
Yeah, I do feel like I belong nowhere and I belong like anywhere. Like I do feel like my tolerance for being in like a strange new place is high. You know, when I'm on tour, if we're in like an odd place for like 2 days, and some other people, I mean, I'm not the only one who enjoys this, but sometimes musicians are just like totally destabilized, like on tour, like you're just like, oh my God, I don't know where I am. I don't know where I've just woken up. And I find it like, I guess it's always like anthropology. Like I'm just like, what's this all about? I'm going to be here for 2 days. Like what's this about? Like, even if it's just sitting in a coffee shop and like watching people. And so I do feel like I developed that really young, and I developed also maybe what I anyway have just as a person from a minoritized background, that you develop an empathy for other people's, you know, like you have a high tolerance for, you know, understanding where somebody else is coming from quickly and like half, you know, explaining yourself to them, for good or for bad. I don't know if it's really good or really bad, but I do feel like at any time somebody asks me what my background is, I have to say something. I have to explain. It's never going to be, I say it and they completely know like exactly what I'm talking about, because there are so few Sephardic people in the world. You know, I think there are less than 2 million of us worldwide. So it's not, you know, so maybe it's an extension of that I am very comfortable being like, I'm weirdly here. I do have moments where I wish that I really belonged, you know, and I had a lot of those moments as a kid. And I actually think learning Spanish was a big part of that I felt very connected to the Spanish-speaking community where we were living in the Midwest, and I felt more accepted. I mean, maybe just because of like maybe my appearance and my background and their background. And so I learned Spanish almost as a way of just fitting in. Like I just really, you know, I'm still working on like a more adult kind of Spanish, but, you know, I really got around well as a teenager in Spanish because it made me feel like I belonged. And that's something that I think we all have to like, maybe this is just my opinion, but I do feel like getting to a place where you feel inside of yourself that you belong, and also that it's okay if you don't belong. Those are two things that if you are going to move around the world outside of wherever you are, you kind of have to make peace with. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about the songs on the album. So a lot of them are about exile. I was thinking about, I probably can't pronounce it, Árboles Lloran por Lluvia.
Oh, Árboles Lloran por Lluvia.
Yeah.
That song, it has a story that goes with it that may not be true, but it is true kind of in the Sephardic kind of consciousness, which is that, you know, it's an old song. The lyrics are older. I don't know exactly how old, but it's an older song. People say that Sephardim from the Balkans, because during the Holocaust, you know, the Ottoman Empire fell in like 1921. That was one change in the Sephardic world, because that was the empire in which Sephardic people were living on both sides of the Mediterranean. And then when the Holocaust happened, Sephardim that were in the Balkan area really suffered. Like 97% of Jews from what is now Greece, and I think a similar percentage from Serbia and Bosnia, like the all of the areas in the Balkans, died. Like I don't want to say died, they were murdered. And it was a massive like trauma that is still an ongoing trauma in the community. And people say that this song was sung on the way to the camps by Sephardim from Salonika. And I've heard that it might just be like we don't know if it's really true, basically. But I will say that I had to. This song reminded me a lot of American like old time songs. You know, just like you know, songs in the, or even like bluegrass songs, like these songs that have traveling to a distant land with nothing, you know, and it kind of has this, it, so I wrote this kind of fiddly sort of melody for it that is very upbeat. And my greatest collaborator and partner, Duncan Wickle, is playing cello and fiddle and like all kinds of things on this track so beautifully. And, but I still, when I was singing it, I had to kind of bear in mind the history of these lyrics and just kind of a way to be sensitive to that while also kind of giving this whimsical life to the lyrics themselves, because they predate any of that history. And yeah, so it's kind of a fun, wild little one.
Árboles lloran por lluvia, montañas por el aire, así lloran mis ojos, ti querido amante oro, y digo que va a ser de mí en tierras llenas me voy unir, me voy a morir. Blanca sos, blanca vistes, blanca la tu figura, blanca flores caen de ti, de la tu hermosura lloro y digo que va a ser de mí.
Yeah. So I was going to ask about Duncan. You've been collaborating with him for many years. And so on the record, like there's tracks overlaid because he's playing different instruments. Yeah. But when you do it live, I guess it's different.
Yeah. I think about this a lot. And I just think, you know, Duncan is, he's a super multi-instrumentalist and plays and sings and plays all different instruments at a really, like really amazingly. And is, you know, he is my longest collaborator. We've been playing together since like 2011, and I'm so lucky to be able to collaborate with him. He plays with lots of other people, and you know, I've learned so much from working with him. But I will say that, I mean, he's much more of a engineering, like of a an artist that deals in the recorded art form. And there's just this big difference, you know, with a recording, you are missing the live music factor. But you can add all this layer to it, you know, and it's like a different art form. It's sort of like I always think, like, it's sometimes irritating to me, like when you see like a music video and the lyric is like, I don't know, about an apple, and the person in the video holds up an apple and like eats it. And it, you know, it's not that that's never acceptable, but film is like a different art form than music. So you don't have to, you can transmit a feeling in a totally different way. And so that's kind of how I think about it. Like, I have all these ways of playing these songs live that are pared down a little bit from the album. But of course, there's the live factor that gets added in the live experience, and just being so present with music and hearing somebody's voice, you know, in real life, like it's just you and that person. And in the recording, it's a recording, so we add, you know, we add things that we'd like to hear, that maybe, you know, yeah, he doesn't have like eight hands, so he can't play like cello and fiddle and bouzouki and guitar at the same time, but they're both really wonderful ways of hearing the music in their own right, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you want to talk about your first album? I mean, it goes back a while, but it's so beautiful. Words Like Yours.
That's so nice of you. I mean, you know, I'm sure like other musicians can relate, like when you hear your, you know, yourself on like an album from like over a decade, I can just hear how much has changed, like how much better I've gotten, hopefully. And also like maybe like I was really young when I was writing a lot of that music. I was in my early 20s, and you know, I mean, in a lot of ways you're the same person that you've always been, but you know, there are things that I would change about how I did my lyrics or like the drama. I feel like when you're in your early 20s, like there's a lot of drama, like your perspective is a little bit, I mean, I don't think like not to dismiss anyone in their early 20s. It's just like a stage that I kind of went through. But that was just such a fun, I mean, that making that album, it was with like a full band, Hagai Cohen Milo, who's also on my recent album, and is an amazing bass player, lives in Berlin now. He was in Boston. He's on the album. Dominic Leslie, who is most recently played with Molly Tuttle in Golden Highway, and is a really old, really dear friend of mine, was on the album. I don't even know how old he was, like 20 maybe. He was like really like a real baby with like hair down like this. And Jordan Tice, who plays with Hawktail and has a really amazing, you know, songwriting career of his own, plays guitar on it. And Duncan, who was like 22, you know, on the album, and mostly plays fiddle. I think that was the other thing, like that making that album, we made it with Omer Avital, who I had been the producer of several projects that I really loved back then. And, you know, it was really like making a live band album. There weren't a lot of overdubs. It was, and I think I had not learned a lot about making room for myself, like, you know, kind of taking, like the difference between being like an egotistical, like singing diva person and just saying, I need a little room for my vocals and like my interpretation to be like central. And I think that was like just a huge learning process. And also, I don't know who can relate to this, but you know, the process of hearing a mix and hating it and having to like take a deep breath and be like, this is fixable. I'm going to sit down and explain how I want, you know, it's nobody's fault. I'm the only person that can express how I want this to sound. That was all a huge learning process that happened with that, the making of that album. And I'm not sure that you can really, you know, if you're an independent artist and you are, you know, really deeply involved in the creative process, I don't know how you get past those learning curve, you know, stages. Like everybody goes through something like that, you know, you hope that you go through them in a way where they're, you know, it's not like a painful growing pain, but you know, there's just like developing your ear, understanding how things work, understanding how to use a microphone, understanding, you know, the tone that you want on the, you know, the violin is a really difficult instrument to record. It just has so many good and bad, or not bad, but like it has so many nuances of sound, you know, how do you want yourself to sound on your recording? So for me, when I listen to that album, I kind of hear my learning process. There is one connecting thing between the two albums, which is there's a song on the first album in English that I took the melody from and recreated it in Ladino. It's Morena Me Llaman on the new album. And it worked thematically, but it also, I just really loved that melody that I'd written a long time ago, and I wanted to give it like a new life.
Morena me llama, yo blanca nací de pasear calana, me color pedri vestido de vedre. Si dice la novia con el chelibí. Ay, la, 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 li, la, la. Aquellas ventanicas, marronjas.
I love to ask singers about the, it seems like, because I'm not a singer, that the voice is an instrument and it's separate from you as a person and it changes and it's vulnerable and how you relate to that as a singer.
That's so true. And I think that's a really, I agree. So, I think it's like an instrument. And I just don't think of myself as like an expert in this. I do feel like singing has come very naturally to me, which does not at all mean that I haven't gone through a lot of my own learning processes or processes. I don't know what the plural is, but anyway, I like that process that I've gone through has still happened. But I will say that, I've chosen over my life to take very few voice lessons. Not because I haven't done my own, you know, listened to what people say about vocal technique or like listened to tons of, you know, singing and made decisions, but just because, it's the voice is so, I mean, any instrument should be like this too, but when you're learning an instrument that you have to play with your hands, and this is just my take. Some people may totally disagree with me, but I do feel like there's this curve where you have to learn how to hold. You have to learn how to produce the sound. And at the very most basic level, we can all produce mostly sound with our voices and we can sing, you know, good or bad. Everybody can like make a sound and sing. So it feels like I kind of didn't want to end up all up in my head about how I was using my voice. I wanted it to just happen really naturally and kind of have my own way of approaching it. And it's still just a process, but it does feel like a relationship that you develop around trust. Like, can you trust it to come out and to be able to control it? And especially like on stage when, you know, people in the audience are not always aware that like maybe your monitor is feeding back weirdly, or you can't hear yourself at all, or you know, the person, you can only hear this one instrument for some reason, and it's like the wrong one for grounding. And there's just a million things like that. You can't stop and be like, excuse me, pause. I need to like make sure that I can hear myself. You have to just pretend that this thing is not happening and be like a professional. And I feel like those situations can make you feel really distant from the production of your voice because you open your mouth. It's so vulnerable. It isn't, you know, like for instance, playing the guitar, like your hand is on a fret, like you can feel, you could be like, I know I'm in the right place, even though I can't hear myself. Like, it's like, you really have to feel inside yourself that you know what's happening and trust that, you know, the sound is going to produce the way that you want it to. And that you'll be able to work with it if it comes out in some different and new way because of the situation. And so, yeah, I do feel like I haven't thought about it this way a lot, but I would say that it does feel kind of like a relationship that is like a longstanding relationship that you have with this thing that's happening. That's kind of like separate and also part of your body.
Yeah. Lily, I saw a video you put out during like the lockdown days of the pandemic. It's on YouTube and it was talking to people about self-care. And you said at that time you were working on your guitar playing because it was less fraught than violin.
Oh, that was probably, there was like a period in the pandemic where my friend Phoebe Hunt was doing, like she was asking all of her musician friends to like post something. I can't even remember what it was for, but I think that's what it was. Yeah, I mean, I think because the violin was like it was the instrument I wanted to play as a kid. I came to it later than other people. I think to some degree I started when I was 11, which on the violin is actually quite late. And I didn't take a ton of lessons. I took like maybe a few lessons and then studied like every summer, like at fiddle camps and stuff like that. So when I got to like conservatory, I went to New England Conservatory for my undergrad and I was in the improvisation department, but you know, I had a lot of, in order to be able to play a different style than what I'd had been playing, it took a lot. And it was very, you know, like I had kind of music school trauma, I guess. Like, you know, it's fine. But I do feel like every single thing that I've done on my own as like an adult musician has felt more free than that relationship. And it's also brought me back to the fiddle. Like I've been able to take that energy that I feel like learning an instrument like the guitar, which has 8 zillion ways of being played. And, you know, you can do it at a basic level or you can do it and be like a crazy virtuoso in any number of genres. But it's also a really restrictive and rigid instrument, but it's also an instrument that's so nice to play and sing with. Like all of that feeling of learning that instrument and of singing has brought me back to the violin in a way that has felt less fraught, like I'm able to come back to it. And I that's probably what I was talking about. Yeah.
I was curious, you know, I'm a violinist and I'm always interested in, you know, people's origin stories with,
totally
the stress and finding their voice and finding.
And it's not even about the violin. Like, I feel like you could feel this way about any instrument, that you've just done from an early age and gone through all these, like, you know, especially because whatever instrument you play when you're younger, maybe you feel this way too. You identify strongly with it. You're like, I'm a fiddle player, you know? And so then you're like, what if I fiddle and I don't like what I did? Like, who am I? I think that's like the big thing for me about instruments that maybe are newer or you didn't used to say. Like, there was a period like when I saying that I was a singer came later. I mean, I sang all my life, but I never said, oh, I'm a singer. And so I think when I really started singing seriously, I was like, wow, this is cool. And I don't feel like I wasn't immediately overly identified with it. So I didn't feel like, oh my God, my identity is living and dying with how this is going, you know? And maybe that's also how I feel about academia, like that, you know, my identity as a musician is lifelong. And sometimes it's like a lot of pressure on myself. So it's nice to have like a thing to step out into. But I'm really conscious that that can happen with anything. Anything that you do a lot and you say, this is what I am, you can end up identifying so strongly with. And then, you know, if it doesn't feel, if something's not going well or like you have like a bump in the road, you're like, oh my God, like, who am I? Like, what am I? You know, am I? It you get really all up in your head. And it's like, I guess just for me, it's very important to have these experiences that like pull me back into, this is creative. And this is, I love this. I mean, I love music. I think about music all the time, like every day, you know? So just reminding yourself that that's why you ended up with this identity, because you loved it so much and you love people that love music and love all kinds of, you know, it's just I love lots of music that isn't music that I'm even going to perform. It's just music that I love.
Yeah. There's a track on your album that's just instrumental. It's you and Duncan playing fiddle, right?
Yeah. And actually, I know that my producer who doesn't come from the fiddle world was like, why would this be on the album? Like it's just fiddle tunes. And for me, it was like a throwback to all the 90s records that had like songs and tunes, you know, like just was like, I want like a set of fiddle tunes. There's like some fiddle tune on one of the songs on Abre tu puerta cerrada. And actually there's one fiddle tune that's by a French composer that I grew up playing that was a really important tune to me as a kid. And then I wrote these two tunes and, you know, he was like, okay, it's fine. But I was like, he doesn't understand. He wasn't like alive during the 90s folk. Like he wasn't involved in like the 90s, like Celtic revival. And he didn't have all those albums like, you know, that I had.
One, two.
Thank you so much for this today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really love this podcast and like the way that I know it's like nerve-wracking for like interviewers to be, oh, I'm going to be like on film, but I've really enjoyed seeing the behind the scenes clips of the person. I just feel like that's so awesome to see the person who you're interviewing like in their house, like talking about the thing. And I just really appreciate everything you're doing.
Well, thanks. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahrosemond.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes.
The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.